Okay, so my doctoral thesis was about how children figure out how counting represents number. So how to use a list of ordered symbols to determine the number of objects in a set. And what made me, so counting, you know, when I tell people, like, people ask me what you work on, and I say, oh, I look at how children learn how to count. A lot of people look at me like with some kind of incredulous look, like, you know, how could you spend 5 years thinking about children counting? Sometimes I wonder about that myself, but fundamentally, what makes me committed to doing this is that I think there's some interesting evidence that this is a case of conceptual construction. And I'll tell you more about what I mean by that. That's the work in progress part, is figuring out exactly what we mean by conceptual construction. And I think that by doing this work, I can contribute to figuring out whether that's a useful notion in cognitive development. So I'm going to start off with some, I'm saying, excessively general and dangerously ambitious remarks on what conceptual construction could be. And then I'll jump in, I'll get a little bit more serious, and I'll talk about more rigorously about this particular case study, which is counting. And I'll give you some evidence that suggests strongly to me that this is really a conceptual construction, and then I'll get into tell you how little babies represent number, because there's a lot of evidence that they do, and I'll tell you how the way in which babies represent number is used to figure out how counting represents number. Okay, so let me start with a negative definition of what a conceptual construction is. I take a conceptual construction to be not hypothesis testing. So that's the negative definition. So what do I mean by hypothesis testing? Hypothesis testing is basically what I think the learning that goes on most of the time. So when we acquire new beliefs, very simple form of hypothesis testing. So, but more sophisticated cases might be when we're trying to determine the identity of something. So I'm looking at some object in the world, and I'm wondering, is that a beach or an elm? So that's a case of hypothesis testing, and then I might go about doing some, getting the relevant data to figure out, you know, what's the answer to my question, or noticing correlations. So might notice that barking tends to co-occur with animals of certain sizes and shapes. You could reframe that as a form of hypothesis testing just by asking a question, you know, what kinds of things tend to co-occur with each other and what kinds of things tend to not co-occur with each other. And the latter kind of hypothesis testing is what I take to be the basic learning mechanism in empiricist theories. So you have like the old like Locke and Hume talking about associations. You basically have a vocabulary of perceptual primitives over which you try to, you know, they wouldn't say it exactly this way, but over which you compute correlations and you try to see what kinds of perceptual primitives go together and what kinds do not. And out of this, you're supposed to get the entire human conceptual system. See, what all these kinds of learning have in common is that they test for combinations of concepts that, or whatever you want to call them, perceptual features that are already available in the mind. This kind of learning cannot generate new concepts in the sense of like new little vocabulary items out of which new hypotheses that couldn't have been thought of before could be generated. This is a point that Jerry Fodor has harped on a lot, which to suggest, and he's pushed this the point he's pushed on is that this type of learning doesn't get you any new concepts, and he thinks that this is the only type of learning that's possible, and he thereby concludes that all concepts are innate. The argument's a little bit more sophisticated than that, that's the thrust of it. But I think that there's actually, and lots of people think, among them, like Piaget, I would put in that category, and now Susan Carey, who I'm working with, and Elizabeth Spelke, and many other people, think that it's actually possible that there's a different kind of learning that I'll call conceptual construction, where you can actually create new concepts for generating hypotheses that could not have been generated before. So I'm trying to give you an example of what I think is a kind of a recent creation in the history of science, a hypothesis that could not have been entertained before Darwin, namely, is phenotype X a product of natural selection, where natural selection is actually a whole theory, a whole organization of concepts of like species and selection and so on, that are organized in such a way that it's like radically different from the concepts that were available prior to Darwin's construction. So this is very, very different from testing to see whether two perceptual features are co-occurring in the world or something like that. Okay, so now let me give you a more positive description of what a conceptual construction is, or how do you know that you're in the presence of one. First of all, you can compare, so suppose we take Newtonian mechanics as our example of what we take to be a conceptual construction. We see that Newtonian mechanics is a conceptual construction because when we look at the mechanical concepts in babies, or even in high schoolers, we'd see that the concepts have less expressed, they're basically organized differently. This is a sophisticated way of saying that the concepts are organized differently, and they're not representing the world quite in the same way. When I get to telling you about the baby representations of number, I'll say more about what I mean with less expressive power and different format. But basically the sense is that there's a different kind of thinking going on there. Another way to see that there's a different kind of thinking going on is that the acquisition, so once the once a culture has established some construction like Newtonian mechanics and starts trying to transmit it to future generations, the acquisition of that construction is a really protracted process. It's not like learning that, nothing like learning that, Washington is the capital of the United States, or even a whole body of lots of memorized facts. It doesn't look anything like that. And the way it doesn't look like just memorizing a big body of facts is that you can see that the initial interpretation, in the eyes of people who actually understand, say, Newtonian mechanics, the initial interpretation of a student taking hearing about this stuff for the first time is going to look completely incoherent. And that follows straight from the fact that what I was saying before is that the concepts that we're born with basically are a different kind of thinking. So an example of this in Newtonian mechanics is you can ask students, you tell them that you give them a ball, and then there's a bucket, you put a bucket ahead of them, and ask them to simply drop the ball in the bucket. And people actually release the ball when their hand is right on top of the bucket. And so when in fact Newtonian mechanics tells you should drop it a little bit before, because as you're walking with the ball has a certain velocity, so when it leaves your hand, it's not going to drop straight, it's going to move with a curvilinear path. The students' concepts of force and motion and so on are radically different from the concepts of a teacher who understands Newtonian mechanics. And so another property of these constructions, which is unsurprising, basically when you start from the fact that the initial state of thinking is radically different, all the other properties kind of follow rather naturally. These things are culturally specific. So even today, not all cultures teach Newtonian mechanics to their to future generations, and they tend to appear late in the history of thought. So even in you have a history of people dedicated to figuring out, say, mechanical interactions between objects in the world. It's not until many generations that you actually arrive at something as amazing as Newtonian mechanics.
And as you were suggesting before, kids have a lot of trouble understanding it when we try to teach it in school.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's something I'll come back to, because I think, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We just finished studying a little bit of Piaget and the conservation concept. Mm-hmm. Can you put that in this context, conservation?
I mean Piaget is a great example. He thinks that there's basically you're constantly undergoing these kinds of scientific revolutions where you're constructing these new representational resources. So I'm by any means I should be ashamed to say not a specialist of Piaget, but I think that different cases of conservation imply different representational resources. So, but basically the difference between being a conserver and not being a conserver, according to Piaget, would, what's missing to the non-conserver, put it the other way, the conservers have a conceptual resource that the non-conservers don't have. So that would be exactly this kind of process that he's talking about.
The difference there, though, seems to be that conservation develops naturally, whereas Newtonian mechanics wouldn't necessarily develop naturally if a person were just left to their own devices.
Right, and Piaget believes that this process actually goes on a lot in ordinary development.
Yes. Yeah, I mean the process I'm going to tell you about.
Actually, you're going to show us it in ordinary development, aren't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the process I'll tell you about learning how counting works is something that looks like it appears rather spontaneously, but I don't know what Piaget thinks about this. I have no idea, but it's one might wonder, whether. We would be conservers if there wasn't some input available from the culture to allow you to construct a new resource. I don't know what Piaget's thoughts on it. Maybe you guys know.
He certainly saw it as strongly connected to constructing an understanding of quantity.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first description of it comes in the construction of the Charles construction of number is where the first description of conservation occurs, even for orange juice.
Okay.
I'm just, since we've thrown Piaget into the mix, I'm just having, can you sort of clarify the difference between a perceptual and conceptual construction?
I don't think there are perceptual constructions. That's my own view of things. I just don't think that perceptual features are organized in the same way as conceptual as concepts.
So you think it's a different kind of learning?
Yeah, basically a completely different kind of learning. So I think the kind of learning that, I mean, this is wild speculation, but my impression from swimming in this field for 5-6 years is that the perceptual kind of learning is you're learning correlations between perceptual features like edge orientation or surface luminances or shapes, maybe if you want to grant that to the perceptual system, and you're learning correlations between features you can already represent. So I don't know, you might learn that if we give the perceptual system a pretty rich vocabulary, you might learn that you can get co-occurrences of big black spots on a kind of white cow-shaped animal. You know, so that you're not generating anything new there. You're just learning that these perceptual features co-occur together. Here you're actually kind of building a new understanding of the world. Does that help?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm not just talking about specifically visual, like perception, but I guess just sort of concepts of the way systems work, or maybe it's just too abstract. My understanding of Piaget was a little more, conservation was a little more perhaps about a perceptual change, but that could be an obvious
assumption. That's why you're right that it as far as what I know about Piaget sounds like he took perceptual features to be basically like sensory motor features to be the starting point of this whole history of constructions throughout development. So probably on his theory he thinks that you can construct new things out of perceptual features. But given what we know about vision now and audition and so on, and they seem to be largely modular systems that are not so much available to each other, that I find it difficult to see how constructions could arise in those systems.
But this will be a topic of major debate for at least the next 20 years.
It will be.
Now, just... I might not have understood exactly what was going on, but I was just thinking, let's say when you for the first time see a tree and it has a branch structure, isn't that a concept that you can then use for all kinds of things, that you perceive it and you would never have come up with it on your own, maybe, right? Like to branch out something, but then once you see it, you can apply this concept to all kinds of organization of information and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right? But to see it, you have to have the concept in the first place. Otherwise, you're not going to see it. You encounter some object in the world, some individual, say a tree, and you're like, oh my God, this has a branching structure. To be able to have that thought, you need to have the concept already. You can't have it without already having the concepts.
But you can apply it in some really new ways, like Darwin did with the tree of life.
Right. And actually, I think that applying these concepts you already have in these new ways is part of the process of conceptual construction. So, for example, this is not something I know very well, but it sounds like Maxwell's theory of electricity, that the kind of sequence of work that led to that theory was made possible by using gravity as a metaphor for the interaction between electrical particles. So here there's concepts you already had from Newton of interactions between bodies that are, pulled together by certain forces. And I use these concepts and I apply them in a domain where they weren't supposed to go in the first place. And that gives me leverage for understanding electricity. That might be part of the process of constructing new concepts. Okay. All right. Okay, so the reason I took the risk of talking about things that are kind of vague and abstract is I think that's still in the works. I think we're still trying to understand whether the notion of conceptual construction really helps us understand development or not. Most of the time I talk as though it's clear, there's all these there are these constructions and so on, but that's just because most of the time I give 20-minute talks and I don't have time for ambiguity. But I really think that that one of the major projects in cognitive development that's going on right now is to see whether this notion actually helps us make sense of cognitive development generally. And if it does, and there's already indications that it does, it's going to have really deep implications for education. And I think it already has. I know there's a rather large literature of teaching conceptual change. And I don't want to get too much into this because some people know this way better than I do. But kind of some of the lessons I take from this are that one of the difficulties, if you're going to teach something that's going to require a construction on the part of the students, one thing that's going to happen is that the teacher and the students are going to use the same words or symbols to mean radically different things, because the students are interpreting the teacher's words in terms of their own conceptual system. You might know these, or maybe other people know them. There's a great series of documentaries coming to understand, like, how the Earth is round, or the seasons.
Private universe.
Yes, that's right. It was made here, right?
Yeah. Right. I think some of the students are from, like, Cambridge Latin Ridge or something.
Actually, they're in the most famous clips, there are Harvard graduates and MIT graduates.
Right.
Making really stupid statements about how the seasons work. And
right, right. So if you're interested in this issue, I highly recommend those documentaries. I think they're really well done and really convey powerfully the implications of conceptual change for education. So one example here of how the same symbol can mean radically different things for teacher and students is that when students are first exposed to fractions, some of them will take a quarter to be a larger quantity than a third, because four is more than three. So their interpretation of that little symbol is completely different from the teachers, but they're both going to talk about quarters and thirds, but they're going to mean completely different things. So I think naturally good teachers will sense that there's something going on, and what they'll naturally tend to do is kind of provide scaffolding to bridge the gulf between the two understandings. They'll first try to elicit their students' understanding. And then in multiple different ways try to make bridges between the understanding they're trying to convey and the understanding that the students have right now. I'm not going to say more about this except to say that I think this is a really important issue, and I really recommend that you look into it. I know, amongst hundreds of papers. One I'm familiar with is by a former collaborator of my advisor. That's why I'm familiar with this. But it's about using the ideas that have been generated by this idea of conceptual construction or conceptual change to teach students to differentiate weight from density. It's a beautiful project. It actually worked. It really helped. That their intervention really helps students figure this out, and it really lays out in a really, really, really nice way what conceptual change means for education. Okay, so now I'm going to start getting into things I actually know something about a little bit more, which is counting as a case of conceptual construction. So I think that counting has most of the properties I talked about earlier, that, as I'll show you later, the early concepts are structured quite differently. Early number concepts are not structured like counting. The acquisition process is protracted and begins with an incoherent interpretation. It's culturally specific. So even now, there are cultures that have been reported not to have a verbal countless representation of number, and these cultures actually have a different understanding of number. That kind of ways of organizing sets into classes is not quite the same as the way we would do it. So that's in a, like, I think October 2004 issue of Science, if you're interested. There's two papers on these two Amazonian cultures that don't have a count list. They're short and really interesting. Counting is not as late an appearance in the history of thought as, like, Newtonian mechanics, but there's evidence that the earliest number representations had a different format. And the format they seem to all have had, so the oldest possible number representation in the archaeological record is something like 12,000 years old. And it's a bone plaque that has a bunch of little marks on it that are grouped in groups of 29, and people think that was a representation of the lunar cycle. The way this number representation works is that for every individual you want to represent, you just make a little mark, right? We're all familiar with that way of representing number. Now, the way in which this is different from counting is that counting and this representation share one principle, which is one-to-one correspondence. But the way this is different from counting is that in counting, when you're done counting, the last symbol you arrive at represents the whole set. So this, in that way, the symbols are kind of independent. So when I tell you five, it means something. But in this bone plaque, for example, if I point to one of the particular lines, it doesn't really mean anything except one. There isn't a single symbol for 29 or 28 or 27 and so on. There's just a whole bunch of little symbols for one. So in this way, the count-based representations seem to be structured differently. And you see these systems based on one-to-one correspondence all over the place. Okay. So what I want to do now is first, I'll start with this over here, show you how the acquisition of counting is protracted and begins with what, in our eyes, looks like an incoherent interpretation, and then tell you about the preverbal concepts and how they're used to construct counting. So in a way, the work I've done is the work teachers should be doing with their students as much as possible, which is, probably teachers don't necessarily need to do that part of figuring out that this is a conceptual construction, but the next part is I figured out how do kids think about number before they figure out counting, and how do they use that thinking to figure out counting. So this is a case study. What would be fantastic is to be able, and I'm not sure if that's going to be possible, but to be able to extract general principles of construction so we understand these processes more generally. And that's like one of my kind of wildest hopes for the work on counting, is that something like that would be possible, that from this work we'll be able to extract more general principles. And actually my advisor Susan Carey has been working hard trying to do this. Okay. So acquisition is protracted. Oh. This is just to tell you what counting is, but you already know.
We actually talked about most of these pieces at the last class.
Okay. Great. Awesome. So what kind of makes sense to establish that counting is a construction is to think about what the acquisition of verbal counting should look like if knowledge of counting were innate, or at least available before the beginning of language acquisition. In their pretty well-known book, Gelman and Galistel argued that they thought that these things were innate, these counting principles. I don't know if it's in that context that you talk about this, but and they argued that basically as soon as the fact that these things are innate, they were getting inspiration from Chomsky's universal grammar theory, where what universal grammar theory says is that you're actively interpreting the input, looking for structure in it. So what this would give children is that they would be actively, it's like non-linguistically, they already have this little count list in their head, and they're trying to find the count list in their language, Some of the evidence that Gelman and Galesel, one thing kids, Gelman and Galesel noticed that some kids would use other ordered lists as their count list, so like A, B, C, D, E, for example. And they kind of made the analogy to overgeneralizations of past tense, so saying things like runned or catched, where the linguistic explanation was that you already have this kind of general rule for representing the past tense, and you're overgeneralizing. So Gelman and Galesel said, well, kids already have these counting principles, and they're actively looking for this ordered list to kind of map the principles onto, and they're actually overgeneralizing the principles or picking the wrong list, just like they're doing these overgeneralizations in language learning. Does that make sense? That's a really important part, that everybody's clear on what... Yeah.
So are you saying that if you were a preschooler... who's counting, you know, you ask them to count to 10, and they're like 3, 7, 8, 4, you know, and they're doing it, that they're, what, so in your mind, what is that then? Do they really believe that the numbers are occurring in that order?
Well, I mean, just that piece of data wouldn't be enough to know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically what I'm going to get to, is that the work Gelman and Galesel did to show what they thought meant that these counting principles were innate wasn't quite enough to really nail it. And when you do more work, you realize that, so for example, just seeing a kid count is on its own an ambiguous event. Just like seeing a kid say words like a third and a quarter doesn't tell you much about their understanding of fractions. Well, a kid reciting a list doesn't tell you much about what they take this list to be. So it could be that the kid you just talked about, 3, 7, 8, 4, maybe the kid there's two possibilities, or maybe more, the two main ones would be, this kid is just confused about the order of the words. He really understands counting. And when if his list goes 3, 7, 8, 4, 9, and you ask him to give you 9 things, he'll give you 5. So that kid really understands counting. He's just confused about the order of the words. Or the other possibility is that you just caught that kid at a moment where he counted 3, 7, 8, 4, 9, and next time you see him, he's going to count 4, 6, you know, always scrambling the words around. So that kid really doesn't understand counting.
But he maybe does understand that those are number words.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Was that the question, or?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah.
Kind of along those lines, what about deaf children, like before even they acquire sign language? Do they have similar patterns of learning, counting, and all the like numerical concepts, because they haven't had that language experience?
I mean, they do have language experience. I mean, if they're deaf living in speaking family,
right.
I mean, that's a really good question, and those would be really neat studies to do. I would predict that until they're exposed to a count list and have actually memorized one, their number concepts are going to work really differently than ours.
So, like, we were talking last class a lot about, you know, some of the studies in 5-month-olds. Do you think at that age you'd see differences between, like, deaf kids and hearing kids?
I don't think so. Yeah. I don't think you'd see differences until about age 3 or 4. And I'll show you why. Okay, so basically the kind of very rough way of putting the prediction of having innate principles would be that learning counting should be easy. And as soon as you've memorized the list, soon thereafter, you know how to use it to represent number. Now, let me show you that this is not the case. Okay, you'll see, I think, 4 children. The first one is going to be doing a little counting task. Has to count, I hope it's going to be clear on the screen. The kid has to count 5 ducks and then say how many ducks there were. And you'll see why like just the act of counting without further probing is on its own ambiguous. Just to be sure, I don't know if this is clear. I don't want to sell the punch of my videotape, but I'm not sure the sound is super clear. So what you'll see is a kid counts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then he's asked how many ducks, and the kid says 2. And I've discovered in my research that that's a very frequent behavior. And then you'll see 3 kids on a different task. Very simple task. Kids are given a bunch of dinosaurs or whatever and are asked to give different numbers of them. The first kid you'll see doing that task understands counting. That's going to be transparently clear. And what's also going to be transparently clear is that the next 2 kids don't. And I'll leave it at that and try to kind of give you the more clean picture afterwards.
Frogs.
Yeah, they are cool frogs. Can you tell me how
many?
3. 3. So it says 3, not
2. Now
6. You know these numbers.
Count.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
How many do you want to be for?
Hey, Steve. Come here.
dinosaurs? Okay. Three? Let me check. Okay, let's check.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Okay.
And what's his name? What's his name?
I don't know. Maybe his name's Bob.
And what's his name?
Joe.
And what's his name?
I'm thinking, I think that was a girl. I think her name is Mary.
Mary was blue.
Yeah.
And what's this one?
That one's name is Mildred.
And what's this one?
Susie.
And
that's what a scary one. It
is a scary one.
See, I'm sure there's
only one in three. You think there's only three? Yeah.
Are there three now?
Yeah.
Check.
Yeah.
This
one, two.
Found two? Can you check and make sure there are three?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
So how many are
there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
You think there's three?
Yeah.
Okay.
Three.
Are there three now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, Olivia. Oh, boy. I love dinosaurs, Olivia.
Okay. So, reactions on this? What did that mean about kind of the status of how knowledge of counting changes through development?
Well, I think it was just interesting that, like in this last one, she was asked for three, and she was counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, so there were three.
Mm-hmm.
So she may have understood the concept, you know, she's like, yeah, there are three here, there's just, you know, more than three, so she might not have really understood the concept of three, like,
exactly
asking for three, meaning yeah. exactly three. She may have understood, oh, there's three here, there just happens to be some others,
mm-hmm.
versus, just, you know, so she may know the concept of three, she just might not understand
yeah.
what that
means. That's a really good point. And I think there's many reasons why that doesn't explain what's going on. The first of them is what you have to wonder why when she's asked for one or two, she gives exactly one or exactly two. And if she made a mistake, actually, she would probably fix it if it's not too big a mistake. So the interpretations of one and two are different from the interpretation of three. But you might wonder, well, maybe some of the words have exact meanings and others have this kind of subset meaning. And part of the process of figuring out number words is you go from this subset meaning to this exact meaning. But actually people have done work. So in pragmatics, so when we say, suppose I had five kids, and you ask me, do you have three kids? And I say, yeah, I have three kids. I'm not really lying to you. So there's a subset reading there. So most of what people have argued is that when the exact interpretation comes from, if I say I have five kids, I don't want to get this wrong, but I don't mean I have at least five. You infer, okay, because I have other words, to other number words, if I have 10, I could have told you I have 10. You when I say I have five, you infer I mean exactly five, because if I had 10, I would have told you I had 10. So it's kind of like a pragmatic inference that you make about what this word means. And people have looked at how early children start to distinguish this kind of subset meaning from exact meaning for this very reason. And it's not until around age 4 or 5 that they start making a distinction. And at first they take, they always take the words to mean just exactly. So if you have, you make 6 horses jump over a fence, and you ask the kid, did 5 horses jump over the fence? They'll say no. Whereas adults will say, yeah. So that doesn't seem to be what's going on. But that's a, yeah. Don't know where to go. People haven't heard. Yep.
I actually had a question. It seems, what is it that happens around 3? Because she obviously understands more than 1, and she obviously understands one-to-one correspondence with 1 and 2. What happens there? Why doesn't she understand past that point?
Yeah, that's the basic. Well, I'll show you why they don't understand past that point, and it comes straight from the structure of the preverbal concepts. There were hands over that before. Yeah.
Sorry.
Watching this, especially the last child, made me think of, sorry to bring it back to Piaget, but his ideas of conservation and the 3 stages that the kids go through. Mm-hmm. So stage 1 would have been the second child that we saw, where he really didn't have much of an idea of number. And it seemed like he had one-to-one correspondence, but that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then in stage 2 of Piaget's idea is kids have the one-to-one correspondence, and they kind of have the idea of one greater than the other, but it kind of starts falling apart while they're going through the whole process. And it seems like that's what's happened with the third child, with the little girl, where she had the one-to-one correspondence, and it looked like she could count, and it looked like she could do it, and then all of a sudden it all just fell apart and it left.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first child was at the stage 3, where he knew exactly what was going on and had no problem with the task.
Mm-hmm. So I think so for Piaget, a stage three kid would be like 5 or 6 years old, right? Is that right?
I think 6 to 7, or
that's kind of for conservation of number you're talking about. Yeah, because yeah. He didn't do right. The S test,
right? So these kids are a lot younger, but we it might be worthwhile thinking about. I think ultimately the Piagetian theory doesn't map on very naturally onto what's going on. Like, I've just shown you a few samples, but people have studied this with all kinds of different tasks and so on. And basically, what they find. Please give me the next slide. Well, maybe I need to switch it to the computer or something, or.
Mouse? Did you try the mouse there?
It's not working. No. Oh, whoa. Okay, so the structure people have found with all kinds of different tasks is the following one. Were there more questions about the videotapes before I kind of give you the more general, fleshed out portrait of what's going on? Yeah.
It's actually not a question, just a little comment.
Yeah.
'Cause probably this, bottleneck.
What?
Well, like bottleneck,
uh-huh.
This barrier, like between 1, 2, and 3,
yeah.
It reminds me of the ancient Chinese, like they use 3 to mean actually many.
Mm-hmm.
It's not exactly 3 for 3; it means many.
Mm-hmm.
So could it be like 1, 2, and then many?
Yeah, that's basically what happens. I mean, what you see in this whole structure of learning is that children step through all the possible number marking systems in languages. So there's this review of some like 200 some languages and how they mark number. And what this guy finds, one thing I want to do before I keep going, I should credit much of this work should be credited to Karen Wynn. She's the one who developed all these tasks. I think she's written great papers on this, and it's important to mention that. But so what happens, what this guy Gravilla Corbett found is that after a review of like 200 some languages, is that there's basically four kinds of number systems. Some languages don't mark number at all, like Mandarin. On nouns, like contemporary Mandarin, or Japanese or Korean. Lots of languages have a singular plural distinction, like English or Romance languages. Other languages have singular dual plural, so there's a specific marker for two. So I'm told that Hebrew, when you say glasses, you put the marker for two on there, or if you say pants, it also has the marker for two. And then there's languages that have singular, dual, trio, plural. So what seems to be going on is that kids are kind of marching through all these possible number marking systems. They start with knowing one, and they take all of the other words to mean more than one, and then they learn two, and they take the other ones to mean more than two, three, and more than three. Some kids actually get four, and then something happens, and they know how to use counting to represent numbers, so they know the meaning of every word in their count list. So that's actually extremely interesting. Another aspect of this work that I find fascinating is the correspondence. This is not always the case, but there's a correspondence between kind of, it looks like, the steps that people have gone through in history to construct the counting system and the steps children actually go through. So it's like, even though the output of the process is a construction, the actual way of getting there is strongly constrained by the concepts that are available, by the structure of the concepts that are available prior to language acquisition.
I know that you started with a nativist orientation, but that's the kind of stuff that Piaget just loved.
Uh-huh.
And he described things like that all the time, how the historical order connected to the to genetic order.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also intriguing that this pattern continues up through, like, older years and fractions. I mean, if you tell a six-year-old, give me half of something, they'll make anything that's less than one and say, here's half. So it's not like a, like, just until there's, like, four or five or something that they have this differentiation or this learning pattern.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the fractions is a different process, but so you mean it's similar in that they don't have an exact interpretation. They start with a
just that it's a loose interpretation of like what she was saying before, one too many, or the gradations within the distinctions aren't concrete.
So half means something like a part of.
Yeah. So it's like it's not just language acquisition, but it follows through our whole understanding of mathematics as children.
These understandings that are like partial understandings of the symbols, or
just what the symbols represent. Like as we understand the concrete meaning of the symbols we create, mm-hmm. they're not. It's not like a get it or don't get it, but it is a gradation of learning.
I see. Right. But I think it's important when we talk about such gradations of learning, we can actually be precise about the structure of the gradation. So there's actually in here what looks like, even though, you know, kids don't learn two overnight. They don't go from just knowing one and many to then knowing one, two, and more than two. It's actually a gradual process of figuring out which sets two goes with. There's something that looks like real discrete stages here that we can describe precisely. And in that way, I, 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 I don't see how this would map onto fractions, for example. Yeah.
Can you just, is this related to the accumulation concept that Wynne was talking about? So the notion of the child start, you know, they get to one and then everything else is more than, then they start to accumulate.
Uh-huh.
They also count in accumulation mode too, et cetera. Is that this or is it?
I think it's quite different. So, this would be a good segue, actually, for me to continue to the next part. But so, let me wrap up what we've said here. What the important point is that around age two, that's the first kid you saw. Kids can count. They have their list has a stable order. They can apply on the basis of one-to-one correspondence at least some of the time. But it takes them about a year and a half to 2 years to actually understand how this list represents, can be used to represent the number of objects in a set. And in the meantime, what happens is they figure out these number words one at a time, learning 1 to 4. And as I continue, so these divisions are going to be important for the rest of what I have to say. So I'll be referring to these kids as one knowers, these kids as two knowers, and so on. CP knower there, I should have said that earlier, is a kid who knows the counting principles, so understands how counting represents number. And I'll be referring to these kids here who haven't yet figured out the counting principles as subset knowers, just so you know in case I start using this terminology. And okay. Maybe I can move on, or... Why don't we take the questions? Yes. Yeah.
I'm just trying to understand this in terms of Wynne's study, where she said that infants have conceptions of 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, like, initially this learning of 1, 2, and 3 is sort of like a hypothesis testing because they're mapping on their concepts 1, 2, 3
a
with
lot
the
like
words.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, like, then the later counting would be what you're calling conceptual construction, right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Sorry, I didn't catch what you just said. Could you repeat what she said?
Yes. Essentially, though I think that even in the learning of 1, 2, and 3, there's some construction going on. That it's basically, when kids are learning 1, 2, 3, they're using concepts they already have to do that. And the real construction happens when kids... So the learning of 1, 2, and 3 looks more like hypothesis testing than it looks like a construction.
It's
actually getting counting that's the construction.
I think that was basically what I was going to ask, but can I just ask it so that if I'm slightly off,
mm-hmm.
you can still help with that. So it seemed like the kids were totally misguided in using counting as a strategy in the video for being able to say whether they had 1, 2, or 3, but it seems like counting is necessary to make it to that past 3 or past 4
yes.
stage, but
right.
is it weird that they're doing it at this point?
That they're doing it at 3
when it's,
or 4?
When it's a misguided approach, because asking for 2 or 3, that's not what... I may be totally wrong, but I thought you were saying that for 2 or 3, they're not actually using a counting principle. They're using
that's
this
right.
other thing, but
that's, right.
that's the approach. When you say how many, they start counting them.
That's right. Well, that's how... So what's happening here is they're given a certain structure by the culture, which is the count list. And they've learned something about this count list, which is you're supposed... It's kind of like... whatever, it's like patty cake. There's a kind of one-to-one correspondence between like hand claps and words or something. So kids can pick up these one-to-one correspondences, I think, rather easily. So they've picked that up. What they haven't picked up is kind of like the cardinality principle, that the last word represents the set. But having this list that they know to apply in one-to-one correspondence, plus what they already, they're like, having that and their pre-verbal number concepts is ultimately, they're going to try to reconcile these two things, and it's in reconciling them that they'll construct a new understanding.
Oh,
Did you have a question or just move on? Okay. Yes, yes. I wanted to show you that. So one concern that people have with the task I've shown you is that it's hard. Rochelle Gelman, for example, has argued that actually there isn't this difference between one knowers, two knowers, and CP knowers at the other end. All that you're seeing is kind of this graded development of counting skill. I tested that hypothesis by seeing whether tasks of varying difficulty actually predicted each other. So if I test kids with a hard task, and that hard task tells me the kid doesn't understand counting, and then I test the same kid on an easier task, do I get the same answer? Does that easier task also tell me that the kid doesn't understand counting, or does it reveal more knowledge? And what you find is this striking consistency between hard and easier tasks. So in a study I did, the hard task was the one you saw. So using that task, I classified kids into one-knowers, two-knowers, three-knowers, CP knowers. And then I tested them on this counting puppet task, so what's hard about this give a number task that you saw is the kids have to coordinate counting and set construction. So they have to take the objects out of the bowl and count them, and they have to do the counting by themselves, and they have to fix and all kinds of things that might be really taxing on limited attentional or memory resources. So I try to take away all these procedural demands by doing the counting for the kids. So I had this little Kermit frog, and I'd ask Kermit to put six things in a bucket, six little elephants. So Kermit would slowly count one at a time the objects and put them in the bucket. And sometimes Kermit would get the right answer, and sometimes he didn't. And the question is, and then after Kermit was done, I'd ask the kids whether Kermit put the right number of things. So if I'd asked for six, I'd say, did Kermit put six elephants in the bucket? And then simply looked at whether kids performed above chance or not. And what you find is, kids who are one-knowers, or basically subset-knowers, don't know the counting principles according to give a number, absolutely fail this task. They're at chance. So sometimes Kermit puts in the wrong number, they say he put in the right number. Sometimes he put in the right number, they say he put in the wrong number. And the kids who get classified as CP-knowers on give a number are perfect on this task. So this seems to be really, really robust. And there's other studies that have been done with different tasks, and they tend to all basically, there's a little bit variation from one to the next, but with all of these tasks, you always find this structure of one, two, three, sometimes four knowers, and then CP knowers. So this is what convinces me that what's going on here is a real change in knowledge, not a change in counting skill. Okay, now let's talk about, the title of this slide is also another hypothesis, that a particular hypothesis about the structure of innate concepts. And I don't want to get into it too much because I don't think I really need to tell you what I need to tell you. So what I want to do is tell you about the structure of preverbal concepts of number, and then how these concepts are used to construct the count list. So the first system I want to tell you about is the one you were referring to, the Wynn analog magnitude system. Actually, this theory of number representation was initially developed to explain how rats represent number, and we found that it actually gives a pretty good account of what we do also. So this is still a system that articulates our number concepts kind of below or together with counting. this system is really more a metaphor than an actual real computational account of what's going on. And the metaphor is that the symbols in the brain are such that their magnitude is proportional to the number of objects in the set. So you might represent 5 with a line that long and 10 with a line twice as long. This representation is logarithmically compressed. There's different ways of caching this out in different models, but basically what it means is that in this system, discrimination is a function of the ratio of the numbers. So if it takes you 2 seconds to discriminate 8 from 16, it's going to take you, let's take an easier one. 5 from 10 takes you 2 seconds. 50 from 100 is also going to take 2 seconds, but 50 from 55 is going to take a lot longer because it's a much smaller ratio. And what you see actually, really beautiful work done in Liz Spelke's lab and Fei Shu's lab, showing that early on babies do discriminate number, and number discriminations show this ratio signature. So, for example, 6-month-olds can discriminate 8 circles from 16 circles or 16 circles from 32, but they can't do 8 from 12 or 16 from 24. And this ratio actually improves with development. There's all kinds of really beautiful work that's been done on this. But one funny thing with this representation is when you get to small numbers, everything seems to fall apart. This might be surprising given what I've just told you, what you've just seen about number word acquisition, but if you use the very same paradigm in which babies can discriminate 2-to-1 ratios, so 8 from 16, for example, and then you test them on 2 versus 4. So let me tell you how this works. Very simple. It's this a method that's used all over the place in development, habituation-dishabituation method. You show babies the same thing over and over until they're bored. Then you show them something that in your eyes looks different. And you see if in the baby's eyes they've picked up a difference too by determining whether they look longer. For number, the way this works is you show like 8 circles over and over or 16 circles over and over. You measure how long the kids are looking. And then you show them a different number and see if they regain interest. So using this method, people have found that babies discriminate 8 from 16 and so on. But then you do this with 2 versus 4, and the babies totally don't pay attention to number. Rather, what they pay attention to is the total amount of stuff. So, like, how much, like, ink there is or whatever. If they're looking at red circles, how much red they're seeing. So if you have 2 small red circles and, 2 big red circles and 4 small red circles that all add up to the same kind of total area, the babies don't budge. It's like nothing changed. Whereas you do exactly the same thing with 8 versus 16. So you have 8 big circles and 16 big circles. Babies pick up on the difference there. And you can really tell that what they're tracking there is number. So what's going on with the small numbers? Well, apparently what's going on is that there's a different system. Oops, I wanted to go the other way. There's a different system for representing small numbers. And this is where things kind of get a little bit tricky. The way this system represents number, I'll refer to it as parallel individuation, is a lot like the early number representation. It kind of puts a mark in the mind for each object in the world. And in babies, this system can't represent any more than 3 things at a time. And in adults, it seems to go up to 4. Some people have argued, and I think you've done work on subitizing, right? I don't know what you think of this, but some people have argued that we still have this system as adults, and it's that system that supports subitizing. And so So the way you see this, the signature of this system is that when babies deploy it, there's an upper limit to their performance. So there's one task in which this has been seen is with like 10-month-old babies. The baby's sitting over there. I put two buckets in front of the baby, and I put, say, a cracker over here and two crackers over here. And then mom lets baby go, and we see which bucket the baby goes to get these yummy crackers. And if both numbers are less than 4, the babies systematically pick the bucket with the largest number of cookies. But if either bucket contains more than 4 cookies, the babies choose at chance. So 1 versus 4, the babies choose at chance. 2 versus 3, the babies go to 3. 1 versus 3, the babies go to 3. But 1 versus 4, the babies just choose at chance.
The opposite of what you were describing before with the perceptual thing. You're going to explain that to us?
Sorry, with
the
what?
The perceptual thing, it was like they were doing the 8 and the 16, mm-hmm. more correctly, but they were getting mixed up if it was 2 and 4.
Yeah. what happens there is if you control for surface area, so if you have one big cracker and two small crackers, the babies go to the big cracker. In most tasks where, but the thing is, what still remains to be true is that as soon as there's more than 3 objects that go into either bucket, even though they're trying to keep track of the total amount of stuff, as soon as there's more than 3 objects, they're not even keeping track of anything anymore. So it's like they're representing each separate cookie, but they're making their decision based on the total amount of cookie rather than on the number of cookies. Is that distinction clear? But there is really importantly one task where you see the signature of this system, but the babies are not tracking volume or total surface area. And that's a task where you put a number of objects in a box, and you let the babies, basically you try to see whether the babies reach in the box as many times as there's objects in there. I'm simplifying, but that's basically the idea. And there, if you put 3 objects in the box, the babies get all 3 objects, but if you put 4, they get 1 and they're happy. But if you put 2 small cars and they get out a big car, they reach 1 more time. So in that case, they're not representing the volume of the object, they're really representing the number. But there's still this upper limit. This all these results are still kind of puzzling to me how to reconcile them all. But there's what seems to be really clear is that underlying this stuff is representations of distinct objects. And you can't represent any more than 3. And in adults it goes up to 4. You can show the same kind of system with other tasks. Yeah.
If you put a big cracker in one bucket and 4 or more in the other, would they choose by chance, or would they?
That's a good question. Supposing that the 4, say you put 6 crackers, and the 6 crackers add up to half the amount of the big cracker. That's a good question. People have never done that. I would predict that they would choose that chance. But that should be done. Yeah. Okay, so I think what we can extract from all this is that there's one system that represents separate individuals. Sometimes it cares about the individuals. Sometimes it cares about their spatial properties, like volume or area. And there's another system that's dedicated to representing number. And that's the analog magnitude system. But the two systems in infancy don't overlap. So one system represents number like 4 or more. If you do 2 versus 4, the habituation experiment doesn't work. But if you do 4 versus 8, it does. So 4 is kind of just straddling the boundary. And the other system does 1 through 3. So I used this difference in the extension of the two systems, the numbers they represent, to try to get a wedge onto seeing how all this numerical machinery is used to figure out how counting works. So as I've already told you, kids learn before they so the question is, what sense do kids make of the number words before they understand how counting works? So what's their first interpretation? That's the part where I kind of turn into a teacher trying to figure out how my students are thinking. And I know kind of from nonverbal tasks what concepts they have available, and now I'm trying to see how they're using these concepts to make sense of something I'm trying to teach them. So we already know that they learn 1, 2, 3, and 4. So that suggests that the small number system is being used, so that the system that can represent separate objects. It's not clear what else could provide. I mean, the situation for representation of the small numbers is still somewhat of a mess, because we see that in adults there's lots of good evidence that the analog magnitude system actually does go all the way down to one. So why it doesn't in babies is a mystery, and people are trying to do studies now to try to elicit the analog magnitude representation even for small sets. So it's actually possible that analog magnitudes do contribute to the meaning of the small number words. But one question I had was, well, we know that babies can represent numbers much larger than 4. So I told you they discriminate 8 from 16 and 16 from 32 and so on. So they have numerical concepts available. The question is, are they using these concepts to figure out how counting works? And all of the work that had been done so far focused on looking at the acquisition of exact number meanings. So like 3, when do kids know that 3 applies to sets of 3 and only sets of 3? And because people had focused on that, they could have missed the fact that babies actually do use these analog magnitude representations of larger numbers, because that system is approximate. So let me show you what things might look like if kids actually used kind of both systems to figure out how counting works. That's something I kind of went over very rapidly, but I told you, so the analog magnitude system has this ratio signature, but another signature it has, which is kind of the same way, a different way of saying the same thing, is that the noise in the system gets bigger and bigger as numbers get bigger. You can actually see this with us. So people have done tasks with adults preventing them from counting and asking them to guess how many objects they saw or to press a key a certain number of times while they were saying da, 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 da. And what you see when you ask people to do this is that the estimates get bigger, but the noise in the estimates also gets bigger. So this is what it looks like. So for the small numbers, things are pretty exact. But when you get to bigger numbers, you start having noise. So you might call it a set of six things 5 or 6, and a set of 10 things, you might sometimes say it's 8, sometimes say it's 12, sometimes say it's 10, sometimes 11. So on average, you're using bigger words to talk about that set than this one, but there's more noise over there than over here. And so if, as a researcher, I only looked at how do kids acquire these exact meanings, I could have missed the fact that kids also get these approximate meanings. And there's other reasons why previous research could have missed this and so on, but yeah. I'm sorry. Did I go over all this too fast? Okay.
I guess what made me come to the question was that I assume that the limit to the number of objects that a kid was giving when they said 3, like in that video, mm-hmm. was their hand size or the number of objects that were available, but I wondered if there was some kind of ratio limit to how many they would actually put there
similar to a 1-to-3 ratio.
Yeah, it's hard to cash this out in terms of ratios because you get the ratio effects in comparison tasks. So there has to be two numbers to get a ratio, obviously. And the task we saw is an absolute number task. It's not clear how ratios map onto an absolute number task, other than the fact that noise gets bigger as the numbers get bigger. So I'm not sure I completely got your question. Do you think is the question, is there something about, say, the noise in the analog magnitude system that there's not much noise for 1, 2, and 3, but when you go beyond 3, it starts to get really noisy, and that's why kids fail beyond 3? Was the question something like that, or?
No. Okay. But I think I see what you're saying about it being an absolute number task, but I guess I was imposing on that if they had an approximate understanding of 3, then they might use this ratio system, and there might be a limit to how many they'd actually give before they say this doesn't make any sense.
So 3 might be 3 or 4.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't be 6.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm just going to try to clarify.
Making a ratio out of the number that you ask of them and the number that they give you, would that approach a limit? If they had unlimited numbers.
That's a way of thinking about it.
Well, I think with kit 2 and with kit 3, we actually, they were asked to provide 3, but the number they put up was so much bigger that it was actually bigger than the ratio that they should be able to handle.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you have two numbers, what they're supposed to give and what they give.
I see.
And I don't know. I mean, I think...
Right. That helps me maybe understand your question. Does that help also? Yeah, okay. Good. Okay, so the question is, before kids learn how counting works, do they look like this? Are they able to do something like this? So we know already they'll be able to do 1, 2, 3, 4. But can they also kind of approximately do the big numbers too? Is what I looked at. Blah, blah. Okay. Here's how I looked at this. Let me go up. What I did is I just rapidly presented kids with different numbers of circles. Just asked them to guess how many circles they had seen. To be sure that the kids understood the task, I first modeled it for them. So there were two experimenters. So there'd be someone else sitting across from me, flashing cards at me with different 1 to 15 circles, and I'd kind of simulate guessing. I'd be, I think that was 4, maybe 5. Yeah, I think it was 4. And then so on, we keep going. So the kids start to understand what we're expecting of them. And they actually have the kids see the cards. They hear what I'm saying. So if they're able to do this, this whole modeling should elicit this knowledge. And then we do it with them with sets of 1 to 10. And the task looks like this. You can try it. Are you ready? You're going to have to guess how many red circles you see. Okay, ready? Go. That's what the kind of... This is an adult version. With the kids, they had about a second. I think this was 10. Okay. And then, so we did 1 through 10... Each set presented 4 times, and we take the average of the words the kids said for each set. And the question is, does the average... So for kids who don't understand counting yet, or maybe just at the cusp of figuring it out, so 3 and 4 knowers, are the kids really just 3 and 4 knowers? Or do they also have approximate meanings that go beyond 4? So do the kids look like this? They can guess 1 through 4, basically, but when we go beyond 4, they get completely random, so the average of the words they say no longer increases? Or does the average of the words they say keep increasing beyond 4? That was the question. Let me go again. And here's what we find. So I first tested the kids on give a number to get their exact meanings, and then tested them on this, like, what I call the fast cards task, because I use cards and I show it to them quickly. And what you find is basically there's no evidence at any point in the sequence of development that the kids can kind of approximate beyond four. So we have our three and four knowers here. They're having a bit of a hard time with three and four, but they can do it. These two means are lower than the higher means there. So these means are distinct from these means and from these means too. So their estimates from three and four are different from the estimates for the other numbers, even though they're not perfect. This might be a slightly hard task is what it means, unfortunately. But beyond four, there's no evidence that they're continuing to be able to guess. And what really nails it for me is that that's really, I think, really interesting, is that you can take kids who do understand counting. So, and I'm going to show you one of these kids. And you what you find is, what I did is I took the slope of the curve over here. And if it's different from zero, it means that the estimates are increasing. Larger than zero, the estimates are increasing. Zero, they're guessing randomly. And I should have this yet. What I found is amongst all these kids who are CP knowers, who understand how counting works, you find a bimodal distribution of slopes. So there's one distribution that's centered around zero, and one distribution that's centered around one. So within the kids who understand counting, it's not, if you prevent them from counting by doing this fast presentation, only part of them are able to estimate beyond four. There's still a whole bunch of them who can only estimate beyond four. Up to four, rather. Now, this is really interesting because it tells us something about what the kids are actually acquiring. What it means when the kids have figured out counting. They basically, all they have is this very shallow procedure for generating sets of particular sizes. Their number words don't have this deeper meaning of like, of a sense of the magnitude that like, you know, if I show you like 10 oranges, like the word 12 is a better description of that set than the word 20. That's kind of a rough sense of the magnitude associated with the words. That's something kids get after they figured out counting. So there's no way it's part of figuring out how counting works, because they get it after. And to show you what this looks like, I actually have one kid. You'll see this kid excellent at counting, and then I'll show you the fast cards task. And you'll see him get the small numbers and totally fail on the big ones. Are there questions before I show you this?
Can you just explain the x-axis?
I'm sorry. Okay. I tend to go too fast over these things. I'm very sorry. So, backtrack a bit. Oops. The numbers that are here is the slope of this curve I was showing you in the range beyond four. So you do a regression, take the slope over here for each kid, and then you map you plot the distribution of slopes. Sorry, I went way too fast over this. So you have like a couple kids over here who actually generated bigger estimates for smaller numbers in the large number range. If I give you the small number range, everybody's close to one. They're all really good. But then, so you have these kids here, bigger estimates for smaller numbers, and kids over here, they all say the same thing for all the big numbers and so on. Does that clarify things? I'm sorry. I went too fast over it. Yeah, thanks for the question. Yeah.
Kids that are around the one slope older than the children?
Yeah, thank you. So If you split this as at 0.3, you find that the group over here is about 6 months older than the group over here, and more generally, the slope in the large number range is correlated with age. So, yeah.
What is the age exactly?
These are on average four, ranging between like 3.5 and 4.5. And these are on average 4.5, ranging between 4 and 5. Okay. Okay, so first you're gonna see the kid, kid doing the, yeah.
Just one more question.
Yeah.
The ones at zero, from the measurement, they're not showing straight lines most of them. They will just be all over the place.
You have the whole thing. So some of them are straight. They're saying the same thing for all the big numbers. Some of them are like this.
But it's kind of, you could make the hypothesis that doesn't anyone who doesn't get one could just be randomly drawing numbers,
mm-hmm.
and if you ran a regression, it was a random drawing.
Mm-hmm.
You still have a majority of regression results basically showing you zero, because it's like, what is the regression going to do with this?
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, let's go with this. So you'll see this child do the given number task you saw earlier, and then the fast cards task. I'll actually tell you how many things are on the cards, because you unfortunately can't see on the video. Should get going. So the first two cards are 3 and 2.
You ready? First one. Ready? Go. 3. Good job. Ready? Go. 2. Okay.
Now 6.
Ready? Go. 5. Okay. Good job.
Now 4.
Ready? Go. 4. Okay.
Now 8. Now 1.
1.
And now 10.
Ready? Go. 5.
That's it. So I mean, to me, this child shows that there's no way that having approximate meanings for words beyond 4 is part of figuring out counting, because this kid clearly understands counting, but can't estimate beyond 4. Another neat little thing here is that actually, as I was alluding to earlier, this sequence seems to be universal. So we did basically the same task in China. And so we first classify our kids into one knower, two knowers, three knowers, four knowers, if we get any. Then do this estimation task with them. And we see that the curves for the Mandarin and American children are just right on top of each other. Except that here, the Chinese kids don't seem to be getting four. So I think four is something that the kids get basically right before they get the counting principles. Because when you look at the data I showed you before, basically almost every kid who understands counting can estimate up to four. So this suggests that this is something they get right about at the time when they figure out counting. But so besides for that, the curves map right on top of each other. So this suggests that what kids are bringing to the task of figuring out how counting works is the product of rather what looks like could be universal cognitive structures. It's a big jump from two cultures to universality, but
It looks like there's some kind of difference in the two knowers also. Is that,
I don't think there's significant difference.
No, same direction, but not statistically reliable. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. No.
I think in a couple of curves now, the two knowers seem to be pretty good at three.
Yeah.
As well.
Right. Good observation. Yeah. You're making me realize I'm going over this so fast, but you guys are good, so that's good. That's right. So using the average of the words the kids say as a function of the number you've presented is a finer measure than what's used with the given number task. In the given number task, people use percent correct. So if kids get a certain percent correct for a certain number, you say they know it. Whereas this, there's no arbitrary criterion like this. You just get the average of what they say. So it's a much finer measure. And what you see is that you get a little bit more knowledge out of this measure than out of a measure like give a number. But the other thing that's interesting is what you don't see is so you'll see some one-knowers who are starting to figure out two, some two-knowers who are starting to figure out three, three-knowers starting to figure out four. You don't see any kids who don't understand counting who are starting to figure out five. And you don't see any one-knowers who are starting to figure out three or any two-knowers trying to figure out four. So it really looks, that's another puzzle. It really looks like kids are getting one first, then two, then three. And given that they're not using counting to learn this, it's a mystery why they're learning it in that order so systematically. I think there's two interpretations, and it's possible that both contribute. One of them is simply the frequency of the number words. So one is a lot more frequent than two, which is more frequent than three. So kids are going to have more chances, opportunities of learning one and two and so on. But I think the other possibility is that initially the meaning of one is part of the meaning of two, and the meaning of two is part of the meaning of three. And that's why the kids are learning it in that order.
Something else about complexity? Three, has more parts than two does.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm not sure if this is a relevant question, but it seems to me that the experiment that you have done to the children has something to do with the short-term pictorial memory skill.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you have taken that into account, I mean, the development of short-term memory.
I have taken it into account. So one way I took it into account is I did the same task, but slower. I just gave the kids forever. They decided when to say what they wanted to say. They could look at the sets as long as they wanted. And what I did there is I simply only took the answers they produced without counting. So if they said 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that's 3, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that's 5, I didn't take those answers. But if they kind of looked at the card and said, a 3, then I would take that answer and I plot again the same plots. I find exactly the same results. But I think even more convincing than this is the last thing I want to show you, which says, okay, so kids aren't using this analog magnitude system to learn how counting works, but integrating the number words with analog magnitude does play a role, a really important role in the development of the meaning of number words. And I'll just end with this. What I did is I also, and this is going to address your concern. I basically presented kids with two opaque boxes and told them that one box had so many fish in it and the other box had another number of fish in it. So like one fish here, eight fish there. And then there's a little bear that's there and the bear's really hungry and it can only get one box. And then I train the kids to learn that the bear really likes to get the box with more, that has the biggest number of fish in it. And I see that the kids are getting this by doing the task with the boxes open first. So we do 1 versus 2, 2 versus 4 with the kids with the boxes open. I see that they get like 3 out of 5 or 4 out of 5 correct in the training, or 5 out of 5 correct. They pick it up very quickly. And then I do the same thing with the boxes closed. So the only way the kids can know how many fish are in the boxes is by hearing the words, by understanding the words. And then I look at how kids perform on this task as a function of whether they understand counting and whether they're able to do the estimation tasks, or put more abstractly, whether they've integrated the number words with large analog magnitudes. So let's see what we get. So no surprise here, starting with kids who understand counting and can estimate up to 10. So these kids have mapped large numerals to large analog magnitudes, and they're like extremely good at all the So what are the comparisons? I'm a bad teacher. I'm assuming that people know everything I know. People probably know more than I know, but in this case, maybe not. So the comparisons were 1 versus 8, 2 versus 3, 6 versus 10, 8 versus 10. We expect pretty much everybody to succeed on this because the groups I have are 3 4 knowers, CP knowers who don't have the mapping, and CP knowers who have the mapping. So we expect everybody, well, this one is a question, but basically expect everybody to do well on comparisons that involve at least one small number. And the question is, how do they do on the comparisons with big numbers? So our 3 and 4 knowers succeed on 1 versus 8. So this suggests, gives us further evidence that probably that the number words beyond 4 mean more than the small ones. Because they know that 8, even though they don't know what 8 is, they know that it's more than 4, or more than 1 in this case. 2 versus 3, so these kids actually know how their small numerals are ordered relative to each other. But when we get to the big numbers, 6 versus 10, 8 versus 10, they're a chance. Now, the cool question is, imagine a kid like the one you just saw. How is that kid going to do on 6 versus 10 and 8 versus 10? So that kid could know it because he understands counting. And there is a way to define ordinality over counting. Basically, later in the list means more. But it's possible that mapping number words to analog magnitudes is necessary for learning that. And indeed, it seems to be. So kids like the ones you saw, just like the 3 and 4 knowers, could do 1 versus 8 and 2 versus 3 above chance, but they were totally at chance on 6 versus 10 and 8 versus 10. So just to make this excruciatingly clear, these are kids who can count 6 objects, they can count 8 objects, they can count 10 objects. But if you ask them which is more, 6 fish or 10 fish, they don't know. It's not until they're actually they have a sense of the rough magnitude associated with each word, so they can estimate, for example, that they know that 10 fish is more than 6 fish. So this analog magnitude system, even though it's not playing a role in constructing the count list, is actually playing an important role in further developments of arithmetic.
So the steps you have are one knowers, two knowers, three knowers, four knowers, and then four mapper, non-mappers, and then mappers.
Yep.
Right. So it's like six steps to get the whole thing.
Yep.
Thanks.
This is really interesting. I'm just wondering if there's any kind of analogous research in continuous quantities. Mm-hmm. So, like, I work with kids a lot, and I remember this one time I asked this little girl, are you taller than the tree? No, that's the silliest question ever. And I said, oh, is the moon taller than the tree? No. You know, so then I was like, oh, that's an interesting answer. So then I started asking all the preschoolers things like, is the bathtub bigger than the pool? Always, no, the bathtub's mm-hmm. not bigger than the pool. But then when I'd ask, is the pool bigger than the ocean? They were like, they seemed to be answering at random, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested if, like, there might be some sort of quantity, continuous quantity, that they understand in the same way that they understand 1, 2, and 3. Whereas, like, when it's something that they can't concretely understand, they're more answering at random. Do you know if there's any kind of...
I don't know if there's... I would guess that there is work on this. Maybe you know about this. Do you know? Yeah. Okay, great.
I'm working on sort of that thing in Carrie's lab right now.
Oh, cool.
It's basically the idea of that is really...
Yeah, there is that work. It's going on in my lab. I didn't know that.
The idea of the countable objects, or more of like a substancey object, is related to count mass syntax, which is in language. So it's like, which we have, whereas other languages, Mandarin, Japanese, don't have. So the difference between being able to perceive that is that you would say some ocean, not, you know, you can't say this is one part of the ocean, whereas you could say this is one microphone. So that difference helps them to not be able to perceive it as quickly. It's that kind of idea.
So it's possible that maybe to map that onto your question is that if you're trying to compare things that are easy to individuate, like objects, you know where they start and where they end, bathtubs and trees and so on, and comparing them to objects that are harder to individuate, I don't know what to do about the moon, but like the ocean, then they might not know how to compare across.
If we only had half an hour, it would be great to be able to talk about that, how this connects to education.
Yeah.
I don't know, do you have any concluding comments you want to make in general, or even more interestingly, about how this connects to education? Don't do it if you don't feel comfortable.
No, I don't think that this... I mean, I think this work has... So there's the unfortunate result that understanding of counting correlates with SES. And there's actually kids who show up in first grade who don't understand counting.
Right, and we're going to be talking about Robbie Case's work
great.
Next week.
So I'd love to have a conversation with Robbie Case and to continue developing the model, to know more about his models,
mm-hmm.
And to see what this work maybe has to say about.
You know, he died a couple years ago. Huh? But so that would be difficult. But Sharon Griffin is right here in Massachusetts, and you could talk to her.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, guys.